call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. We're going to switch the agenda up here a little bit. Representative Hansen does have some constituents that he needs to meet with. Representative Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Yep. Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd move House File 2408 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
All right. Representative Hansen moves House File 2408 to be held over for possible inclusion to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 2408, you may remember we heard this in a presentation in the Joint Committee, and then it was heard for those of you who are in the Policy Committee. So this will be the third hearing. This is developing an Emerald Ash Borer Suppression Program. For the finance considerations, we're asking for $13 million in general fund to help with responding and helping prevent future emerald ash borer infestations in Minnesota. And I have with me the Minnesota Nursery Landscape Association to show their support for the bill. And in the interest of time, I also want to recognize the League of Cities also supports the bill as well.
All right, wonderful. If you state your name for the record, who you represent, begin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tim Power. I represent both the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association today and also the Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Committee.
Welcome.
I'd like to make two points on the policy side of this issue as you consider the finance aspects. First, emerald ash borer is here and it's moving. Since its first discovery in the state of Minnesota in the extreme southeast corner and then in St. Paul in 2009, the bug continues to move. In 2015, we went from six counties with certified infestations to 12 plus Park Point in the Duluth area. A number of these cities have moved well down the death curve that was described in the hearing on March 16th. As a matter of fact, City of St. Paul last week released a statement saying that they had found more infested trees in the first 3 months of 2016 than they had in all of 2015. So this bug is here and it's moving, particularly in those areas where it's had a chance to gain steam. Second, the process of using certified applicators to inject systemic insecticide into trees limits insecticide dispersal to the tree itself, thus maximizing pest control within the tree while minimizing any possible exposure to non-target organisms. So that's just a brief review of the policy side. And on the finance side, I would remind the committee that at the height of the Dutch elm disease epidemic, the state was spending upwards of $30 million a year to provide assistance to cities in dealing with this project. Though ash trees do not have as large a stature as do elm trees had a tendency to retain their structural stability after they were dead for a period of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Ash trees, which are used to make baseball bats, become brittle very fast. So the prospect of providing money for cities to create this orderly transition away from ash and towards a more diverse community forest provides, in my opinion, and I think that of the bill author, the best opportunity to defend against this pest. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take any questions if possible.
Thank you, Mr. Power. Any questions for the testifier or the author at this time? Question. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, or the testifier, what else is being done in Minnesota at this time on the emerald ash borer infestation?
Mr. Power.
Mr. Chair and
Representative Hansen.
Essentially removal. You have communities that are preparing by removing and then responding and removing.
In addition to that, there are a number of cities that are actively planting in preparation for or in response to emerald ash borer infestation. City of Minneapolis has created a gravel bed nursery. The town of Hendricks in extreme western Minnesota has created a gravel bed nursery to provide the planting stock that will follow on after the ash are gone. These are the cities that have responded proactively. Many cities have not because they're either unaware or unable to prepare in such a way.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the appropriation, I see it's $13 million per year for fiscal year 17 and 18. How did you arrive at a total of $26 million?
Representative Hansen or Mr. Bauer? We'd like to take that.
I'm sorry, I missed the last part of the question. How would that?
Representative Fagan. Thank you, Mr. Chair. How did you arrive at the appropriation in the bill of $26 million? Mr. Powers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The basic concept is it's $3 per person within communities in the state of Minnesota, and it's a very rough approximation of the cost that other cities who have had successful community forestry programs in the past have used to determine what it takes to fight not only this kind of an infestation, but community forestry issues to retain that healthy forest.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Hansen, I'm curious, I didn't catch, you gave a list of, I'll say, stakeholders that support the bill. Can you redo that for me?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Fabian. So there's a lot of citizens that are supportive in many of the communities that are represented by some stakeholders like the Minnesota Nursery Landscape Association, the League of Cities. But I can tell you, contacted in my communities, regular folks who don't belong to any organization are very concerned about their trees. And I think you'll find that in all of your districts, that there's a broad citizen awareness, I think, on your dashboard. And so the stakeholders are involved, but I think the citizens are actually leading the response to this and helping prepare.
Dr. Fabian?
All right. Thank you. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I appreciate this bill being brought forward. Has there been any contact with any of the forest industry aspects about what's going to happen in northern Minnesota? And the reason I ask that is if in Kuching, St. Louis County, and others that have large tracts of black ash, if they get into those tracks, it'll make the tracks useless and turn them into a stagnant swamp. So I'm just curious where if other industry groups have weighed in on this.
Bauer? Mr. Chairman and Representative, certainly the forest industry is aware of emerald ash borer and its encroachment, and the issues are very different between communities and the ecosystems outside of the communities. Black ash is a huge problem, and there are close to a billion ash trees in the state of Minnesota, the vast majority being black ash. The forestry community is well aware of the issue. My particular industry has not communicated with the forestry industry on this, although we share this as a common problem.
Representative Eklund, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And part of the reason for that questioning is I just believe that it's going to end up being a larger issue than $26 million if we take a look at it that way. So thank you.
Thank you. Next, Representative Anderson, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the Finance Committee, and the research that we have says it's coming from an unspecified fund. There's no mention of where it's going to come from. Can you help us out with that, Representative Hansen?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. I had mentioned in the testimony I would prefer the general fund. I think that's where the Minnesotans, regardless of their background, benefit from the trees. So whether it's black ash up north or green ash in Minneapolis or green ash in Houston County, I think general fund is the appropriate source for this. You know, we did that. There is some legislative history. In 2009, the Outdoor Heritage Fund did $2 million. And I actually believe that $2 million has helped, actually is still helping us, because it provided for that immediate response when we were getting that reaction, when we were getting the infestation. So the ability for the cities for that $2 million all over the state used that very well. I wish we had continued $2 million a year. I think under the Constitution, protecting the forests wherever they are, that was a legitimate use. There were others who disagreed. So now we're playing catch-up again. I think that is a use for detection to protect the forest, but we're already appropriating those dollars. So right now, because there hasn't been any expenditure since 2009, 2010, we're having to catch up. And if we can detect the bug, and as Tim had mentioned, Mr. Power had mentioned, the bug is coming, the bug is here, we want to disrupt its travel plans. We want to make sure it's not moving around faster. So if we can slow the infestation, we can suppress that, and then we can work on reforestation with diversity so the diverse amount of trees can lead to more resilience in the future. So whatever the next bug is, we don't have to go through this as we did two generations ago with Dutch elms.
Chair Anderson?
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that kind of leads up to the other question I had in terms of moving forward. When you replace all of these trees, I've heard maple is a good tree, but we can't put, as you say, all of our eggs in one basket. What's the prognosis looking down the road as to how we diversify our trees?
Mr. Power.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson. We made the mistake in the 70s and the 80s in replacing elm with ash because ash was simple. It doesn't really care what kind of soil it goes into. It's tough and hardy. I think our industry and our state has learned a continuing lesson that diversity is important. We used to use the 10-20-30 rule, and I won't go through that, but that's even too broad. We need to have a more diverse urban forest, community forest, and the way to accomplish that, we have to accomplish that. And the nursery industry is prepared to respond. One of the largest wholesalers in the state is right here in St. Paul, Bailey Nurseries, and they provide a broad, diverse range of plants available to the industry. They're one of many. We just need to take that to heart and, as citizens, demand more from my industry in terms of diversity. But that already exists.
Chair Anderson, follow-up? Representative Fabian, do you have a follow-up question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just two things real quick. To Representative Eklund's questioning about the state forest and so forth, if you're interested, Mr. Chair, I see DNR is here, and I don't know what your schedule is like. If you wanted to hear something from them, we certainly could do that. But I do have a point as to the finance on this, the $26 million. It's $3 per person. So hypothetically, if this doesn't pass and doesn't get into legislative language, what's going to happen? I mean, are the cities that are really most impacted by this going to assess to their local citizens at $3 per person through their budgeting processes in their cities, or what steps would you recommend?
Ms. Bauer, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, what the cities will do is do what the ones that have the infestations are doing now, and that's to react. And they have to react by removing, and so there's costs there that are going to be borne by the property taxpayers in the city. So it's going to be the larger the infestation, the more the cost.
President Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and to that point, can't they be doing something now to be proactive rather than reactive? The industry is there. It's ready. Sometimes in our processes here, things move slow. I guess I'm looking for why not be more proactive and start this process as individual cities if that's what they think is best for them.
Ms. Bauer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian. Some cities have. As I mentioned, the town of Hendricks has done a great job on their gravel bed nursery. Not every city has. Every city has lots of competing interests, and Emerald Ash Borer is only one of those. This has just not risen to the level that requires immediate action and immediate dollars for those cities. I'd like to make the point that this is going to be costly not only in terms of dollars, but in terms of logistics. Cities in Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan, where the infestation started, discovered that it was literally impossible to find enough tree removal people who are qualified to remove these trees in a timely fashion. That's what this bill attempts to do, is to allow cities the opportunity to create this orderly transition away from ash. Cities should be not only planning for removal of their not high-value ash at the moment, they should be planning on replanting. These state funds would give the cities the opportunity to focus state dollars on retaining their high-quality ash while this process is underway. Otherwise, these trees are largely going to die in a very short number of years, and we're going to have a major public safety problem all at one time.
Fabian? Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Hansen, final word?
I'd appreciate whatever we can receive for this. I think it's a responsibility. Representative Fabian, if a city has local leadership and they, or if they have to react immediately, they can do that. They have that ability, but it's going to be difficult because the bug does move. So you may have a downstream or a downwind, or if Tim drives in and the bug gets on his car and it goes for a travel down to back home with him, and then the infestation starts. That's where the statewide responsibility and prevention is better than cleanup on many things. So if we can prevent this and have that statewide response wherever we are to prevent these types of things, I think that helps the local communities so they're not feeling alone and not having to deal with it as it moves. I mean, you can watch the map as it moves, and then you have the reaction. And so it's going to be dealing, citizens are going to be dealing with this all over the state if we don't take some action. So I'd appreciate and I appreciate the leeway on time.
Yeah. Well, before you renew your motion, Representative Hansen, you know, the ag budget is a very small budget, as we know, and this would equate to about, what, almost 20% of our budget if it was fully funded. Are you speaking to any other, looking for any other avenues as far as financing as well?
Mr. Chair, and I think in one of the earlier committees I mentioned that the responsibility when a pest comes into the state rests with the Department of Ag, and after it's established, it resides with DNR. I've had some contact with DNR. As you know, agencies become territorial in terms of what their responsibilities are. I think as this becomes established, I think the role is still there with the Department of Agriculture. And I go back to what Mr. Power had mentioned. If we look back to the 70s, we had a massive amount of public investment. And we have not had that. Wherever the source is or whatever an agency is, we have not had that with Emerald Azure.
Representative Hansen, I think you just made the case that we should bring the DNR in underneath the Department of Agriculture's jurisdiction. So with that, Representative Hansen renews his motion that House file, this number again, 2408, be held over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Representative Clark, did you have some testifiers that have to be leaving early? So I want to make sure that we do make it to all the testifiers. If not, she's looking around. Where's Miss Place? Is she here? Can we get the department to come up? Okay. So waiting for Representative Clark's testifiers all to arrive as well. Miss Place, we have a very busy day today. We have three more bills on the agenda. So if we could go ahead and go through this report as quickly as possible. Hit the highlights, if you would, please, and take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Whitney Place. I am the Director of Government Affairs at the Department of Agriculture, and I would like to say that at the Department of Agriculture, we support all forms of agriculture, including urban agriculture, and we are grateful for the opportunity to present our report today. I have today with me Paul Huguenin. He is the Marketing Section Supervisor at the department.
Welcome. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Paul Huguenin with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Thank you for the opportunity to present a very brief summary of our report on urban ag in Minnesota. I believe all of you have a copy of that in your packets. The report is a result of 2015 legislation that directed the Department of Ag to convene interested stakeholders, pay particular attention to the definition of urban ag, and come back to this body with suggestions, feedback, and recommendation. Our focus was in gathering stakeholder input, gathering public input, and to do this we developed, among other things, an online survey, distributed paper surveys that were translated as well into Spanish and Hmong. We facilitated three public meetings to gather input and encouraged direct public input and promoted the conferences through a statewide press release. We also visited a number of events like the Food Access Summit in Duluth, Extension's Urban Ag Symposium, and the Homegrown Minneapolis Open House. We were really encouraged by the amount of response we received from the public. The survey alone generated 390 responses from people throughout Minnesota. Along with the stakeholder input, we spent a great deal of time reviewing the national literature related to urban agriculture. Our goal with this report was to create something that would have value to urban farmers, advocates of urban agriculture, and policymakers at all levels of government. So you'll notice the report has an extensive resource inventory, both local within the state as well as national and regional resources as well. One of the key things we were asked to do is look at the definition. And so, you know, basically the take-home message that you'll find in the report is that people were pretty strong about saying that the definition of urban agriculture is and should be very, very broad, both in terms of products, in terms of place, and in terms of scale. Product-wise, people were very supportive of having it be broad, including everything from food products, small animals, aquaponics, apiaries, non-food items like flowers, nurseries, and medicinal plants. With regard to the end use or the purpose of urban agriculture, we also heard loud and clear that that should be broad. Commercial production, items grown for educational or training purposes, items grown for personal use, and items grown for donation. But one of the things that was really of interest and caught us a little bit by surprise was that people were very, the overwhelming response was that people thought that the size of the urban area was not important when discussing what that term means. In fact, over 250 of the people said that the size of the city shouldn't matter in this, which was interesting because the vast majority of the survey respondents were from within Hennepin and Ramsey County. So one of the take-home messages that we would pass on to policymakers of all levels is that with such a broad view of this term, it's really important that each individual law, policies, and rules include a clear definition of the intended audience so that there's not confusion or unintended consequences. There are several reasons that urban ag has become such a hot-button issue in Minnesota as well as nationally, and I know that you'll hear a lot of testimony in that on your upcoming bills, so I'll leave a little bit of that out. Know that you'll find it in the report, and it's everything from food access to healthy eating to equity to the environment. One thing I'll point out is that in addition to pointing out the perceived benefits of urban ag, we also asked people if they had any concerns about expanding urban ag. Not surprisingly, in this survey, there were not a whole lot of people with concerns, but it is of note that more than 100 people talked about the potential issue of contamination on urban land. Others expressed their opinion that urban land should be used for other purposes like housing or for business. And there were also some folks who wanted to emphasize that they wanted to make sure that limited resources wouldn't be taken away from traditional rural agriculture to focus on urban ag. Public input and national lit reviews also highlighted several barriers that need to be addressed in order to advance urban agriculture. Land access was certainly front and center, particularly long-term access to land. Local policies, things like zoning, permits, and ordinances, things that are largely put together on the city level, were very much front of center when we asked people of what the issues were. And then, of course, you know, lack of funding for farmers, particularly new immigrant populations, as well as organizations and local units of government. Along with that was pointed out the need for technical assistance, training, particularly for urban producers and backyard gardeners. I'd like to close with just a couple of highlights in the report that I haven't touched on yet. One is that urban agriculture spans the missions of a number of state agencies and a number of organizations. For-profit agriculture clearly is consistent with the current mission of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And in fact, we've used Agri's value-added grant program to fund several urban ag projects. But some of the other things that you'll find outlined in the report, such as community gardens, technical assistance to backyard gardeners, initiatives to improve health, access and equity, working with disadvantaged groups to provide job training, some of those missions align more closely with other organizations ranging from Extension, Department of Health and the SHIP program, Department of Economic Development, or the Department of Human Services. A second key point and an opportunity is that local governments in the Twin Cities metropolitan area are required to review their comprehensive plans and land use regulations and submit updates to the Metropolitan Council for review by December 31st of 2018. This comprehensive planning requirement provides an opportunity for advocates of urban agriculture to encourage local municipalities to include urban ag language in their comprehensive plans and zoning revisions. And finally, a unique issue that I wanted to bring up because it's one that I don't think many of us often realize, but the Hmong American Farmers Association brought this to our attention. And what happens is that many of the Hmong farmers live in urban areas but farm outside the urban area in rural areas. And this has caused them some unique challenges, particularly when it comes to some federal funding opportunities. Some of the grant applications on a federal level award priority points to farmers located in economically disadvantaged areas. But because their farmland is not located within those areas, they miss out on those priority points that they otherwise would normally be expected to receive based on where they live. And that's one of those clear examples that kind of highlights what I mentioned earlier, which is that policymakers at all levels need to make sure that they've defined urban ag clearly and in a way that matches up with the intent of their specific policies. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present kind of an abbreviated snapshot of the report. My contact information is on the cover of that report, but certainly would also be happy to respond to any questions at your convenience.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifiers, members? Any questions? I think we did a nice job running through that. So stick around, please, in case any questions come up. I do want to make a point. You know, I've come a long way to understand the importance of urban agriculture. And I'll just say it. Initially, it's more than a garden and growing a carrot. I mean, we have heard wonderful testimony about all the benefits. And if I can go there one more time, look around the room. I've said this before, in the Ag Committee, never have we seen so much color in this room as we do today, and it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. And we hear the benefits. I want to make this work, figure out how we can make this work. And when we're talking about this, I've said all along that we're all in this together. When the testifiers come up, I've always said as a chairman, I've got one rule, if you will, for testifiers. I said we will not tear down one segment of agriculture trying to promote another. We're all in this together. And Representative Clark's really helped me understand the importance of urban agriculture. And I've moved. I've come a long way. And I hope that we'll all continue to do that to bring groups together. And, you know, I've always said, you know, for whatever reason, we have all this internal fighting within agriculture, food versus fuel, urban versus rural, large versus small, conventional versus, you know, traditional, GMOs versus organic. I said, we don't need that fighting. We're all in this together. And so, again, I've come a long way. My friend, Representative Clark, has helped educate me on this, and I really appreciate everybody being here. And I want to figure out how we can make this work. So thank you for your testimony. Thank you. What we're going to do, I think we have three bills up. Representative Clark, do you have a testifier that has to leave right away? Because we also have, I believe we have testifiers from the Duluth area, is that correct? Is Representative Simonson here? Representative Simonson, why don't you come on down? Do you need a lot of time? Wonderful, come on down, we'll do that. And I like the way you think. And we want to get to your testifiers as well. They've traveled a long distance, Representative Simonson, so. Okay. All right. So while they are setting up the presentation, Representative Johnson, have you had a chance to look over the minutes?
Yes, I have, Mr. Chair. I move the minutes.
Find my minutes. Where's the date on this? Thank you. Representative Johnson moves the minutes dated from March 31st. Any discussion on the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Are we all set to go?
Mr. Chair, we are, by the time I finish talking, they will be ready to go, yes.
All right, wonderful. I'll move your bill to put it before us, House File 3358, to be laid over for possible inclusion. You're laying this one over, right? And to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for the opportunity to talk a little bit about this bill. And this is a unique bill, I think, in the frame of the discussion that you're having today. And I'm not going to say a lot. I'm going to turn it over to the testifiers for just a brief testimony. But I do want to say a little bit about my district and about the economic demographics of what we're talking about, because I think it's important to put it into context when we talk about the scope of this project and the impact that it would have to our community. And that is very simply that fully one-third, 33% of the households in my district have annual incomes of $25,000 or less. So it's very important when we talk about access to food and access to healthy food, and that is, you know, one of the primary reasons why I agreed to take this bill forward and present it to you. And Mr. Chair, you know, I know you probably don't know what your target is yet and if you'll have an actual supplemental bill, but if you do, I would just hope that you would take the opportunity to consider this. It's a $200,000 request. You don't often see requests that are in the $100,000 ranges instead of millions. So I would hope that you would consider that, but I'm going to turn it over to our first testifier, who is Shanti, and she runs the Seeds of Success program in Duluth. So with that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record. Who you represent? Begin.
My name is Shanti Calabria, and I am here on behalf of Community Action Duluth, and specifically the Seeds of Success program.
Welcome.
Thank you for inviting us to be here today. I'm just going to start and share a little bit about my program with you. We are an urban agriculture and transitional employment program with three main focus areas. Our first is food access. Our second is neighborhood revitalization in the context of urban food production. And our third is transitional employment. In any given growing season, we produce about 10,000 pounds of food. Currently, we have 5 sites around the city of Duluth. And last year, we hired 8 people as transitional employees. And those are people who have barriers to employment, and we employed them as urban farmers. The Greenhouse Project is a project that's basically been a collaboration of several different entities. Before I get into that, I'd like to say really quickly, we also run a farmer's market. We run an 18-week seasonal market in a part of Duluth that is considered as a USDA food desert. There's 6,000 people that live in this neighborhood, and there is no grocery store. So for 18 weeks in the summer, we are able to connect neighborhood residents with local vendors and producers. And it's really meaningful, but it's obviously only for 18 weeks of the year. So in general, as an urban agriculture program in a northern climate, we face the constraints of climate. And we wanted to think about how we could continue to grow food year-round and meet food access needs in this neighborhood year-round, and not just for 18 weeks of the year. So that's where the Greenhouse Project really came in. And we thought if we could build a deep winter greenhouse, which is a structure that's optimized for deep winter growing, not only could we grow food in the middle of the winter, but we could also continue to meet food access needs by the creation of a winter market. We could also employ more people as transitional employees, and our program has a really good track record of folks who have gone through a transitional experience then going on to longer-term, more stable employment or going back to school. In addition, we thought it would be a really great, innovative way to talk about community food systems. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to one of our partners, Lisa Plekta of the Junior League, and then we'll hear from Keith Hemery at the City of Duluth.
Thank you, Ms. Calabria. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Plekta. I am the chair of the projects for Junior League of Duluth. Junior League of Duluth is a women's service and leadership organization deeply committed to enhancing and strengthening our community. For the past 3 years, we've been working within our current program, Let It Grow, with the goal of establishing a food-secure community through empowerment, enrichment, and education. As one strategy within this broader program, we've committed $100,000 of funding to build this deep winter greenhouse, and we will continue to educate and engage both our membership and the larger community on the critical issue of food insecurity. We have a 95-year history of supporting initiatives that are pertinent and need-based. Many of our former projects that required years of planning and involved substantial fundraising continue to thrive and grow today as independent programs. Our hope is that this project can serve as a source of local pride and a model for other communities. And our vision is to be catalysts for lasting community change. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Plekta.
have another testifier? One more.
Please, Mr. Chair and Representatives, thank you for having us here today. My name is Keith Hamry. I'm the Director of Planning and Construction Services for the City of Duluth. The site that we have for this deep winter greenhouse is located next to Denfeld High School in Duluth, 45th Avenue West in Grand. And this site was a flood damage site from 2012. And I want to thank the representatives for your support in helping us recover from the flood. There was a church on this site with an adjacent parking lot that was damaged by the flood, and we had to demolish the church site. And the site is in ownership of the city. We then have acquired the parking lot site that was adjacent to that. And it's the combination or collaborative effort of our community partners that we brought here today, along with Seeds for Success, the Community Action Duluth, the Junior League. We've also brought the Duluth Community Garden Program, who's going to build a community garden on the front part of the site. And we also see a lot of synergy for our community with this redevelopment of a green space. We have a high school. We have a Whole Foods Co-op that was just opening across the street from this. And this site, for the chance to tie all of this together as a green site and also a redevelopment and primarily a healthy food access site. This part of our community currently, through our health impact analysis, lives 10 to 12 years less than the rest of our city. And that's due to lack of access to healthy nutritional food. And so therefore, we're looking at this partnership of many partners to look at a budget that's $465,000, of which $130,000 is coming from the City of Duluth through our Community Development Block Grant Funds, $35,000 from the Center for Prevention, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and $100,000 from the Junior League of Duluth through their fundraising efforts. And the City of Duluth is asking for this $200,000, and we would make sure that it's done appropriately and follows all the state regulations and appropriate bidding process. And we really see the potential benefit for our community, and as Representative Simonson mentioned, the people in this part of our city who are low to moderate income and having health access. So with that, I'm going to ask Shanti to describe in detail for you the deep winter greenhouse.
Thank you, Mr. Hamry.
Okay, so you can see on the monitors, and actually we do have some boards. Would you mind holding those? Okay, so I'll just do a really brief overview of this site itself. So that's the lot that Keith referenced. The greenhouse has an east-west orientation with a south-facing window. And you can see that the community garden plot is a little further ahead of that. This is just an overview of the interior of the site itself. So there's a production packing area, but the majority of the space, it's about a 2,100 square foot building with over 1,300 square feet of growing space, is toward the front. And so we intend to really maximize vertical growing space, growing with containers and also in gutters, and then some in-floor beds as well. The last drawing is just really trying to illustrate how we're trying to make this building as energy efficient and passive solar as possible. So the way it's set up is that south-facing window, the exact angle is calculated with something called the solar incidence calculation to basically capture the most available amount of light on the shortest day of the year, which is the winter solstice. So that light energy comes into the structure, it's transformed into heat energy, and then it rises to the ridge. From there, through very efficient ventilation and piping, we'll be piping it beneath the structure, so you can kind of see that there's that beneath piece. That will be a subterranean heating system. So we're trying to basically capture hot air and then have it slowly release back into the structure itself. So it's designed to be very long-lasting, very energy-efficient, and with LEED-certified processes.
Thank you, Ms. Calabria. Any questions for the testifiers?
Yes, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One word that stood out was the word access. This is right on Grand Avenue. That's a main artery in town. Is there a sufficient public access, let's say bus routes, so the entire city could take advantage of shopping in your greenhouse setting?
Mr. Chair and Representative Sundin, yes, this Grand Avenue is a major bus route through our city and one of our highest bus route commuter routes within the community, and primary access multimodal access for our low-income residents.
And Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering about this food desert situation you talked about. How far is it to the a grocery store from, let's say, this site?
Yeah, so if you're in this particular neighborhood, you're about 3.5 miles from any particular spot in the neighborhood to a grocery store. That has changed recently. When Keith mentioned the Whole Foods Co-op, that's our local co-op, and that will be right across from the greenhouse site. So it will be probably about 2 miles away at that point.
Thank you. Just a comment. I realize there's some convenience stores that have been erected in that area, but they pretty much sell donuts and convenience foods. So I think this is a terrific idea.
Thank you, Representative Sundin. And Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your city sounds like it has a well-organized urban agriculture program, and my question kind of deals with your program in general. Down here, it seems like the problems involve securing a site for a garden spot and then securing that for a period of years. And you say you have 5 sites up in your city of Duluth. Mm-hmm. How do you go about keeping those sites year after year, or do you move around, or does the city guarantee you these locations?
Ms. Calabria.
Thank you. That's a great question. It really depends. It's site to site. So we do have some sites that are longer term, more secure. We also have some sites that we lease through the Housing Redevelopment Authority. So it really depends. We're actually in a process right now of transitioning to some longer term sites where we can grow more perennials, because historically we've had to move sites very frequently. Because of our partnership with the city on this greenhouse project, we feel very confident that this will be a long term site for us.
Chair Anderson. Any other questions? Seeing none. Any final comments there, Representative Simons?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, just for the opportunity. And I just want to highlight, I think they did a great job, but the brevity of the presentation no way represents the incredible impact that this relatively small amount of appropriation would have on our community. So I just appreciate your time and thank you for your consideration.
Duly noted. Thank you so much for bringing this forward. So I'll renew my motion to hold over House File 3358 for possible inclusion. Thank you. And travel safe back to Duluth.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Clark. So Representative Clark, you do have 2 bills up today. I believe you have a testifier that has to leave early. Is that correct, Representative
Mr.
Clark?
Mr. Chairman, the circumstance got changed a little bit, so okay. She can stay. So I'd actually think one of my other testifiers on the second bill would have to go. So I'd like to maybe start with that one first, 2818.
You want to start with, said House File 2818?
Yeah. And then we'll come back. And Mr. Chairman, so I guess I'll move that bill first.
All right. Representative Clark moves House File 2818 to be held over for possible inclusion. Representative Clark, to your bill.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, members, you are going to hear, after we finish with this bill, the kind of the general overall issue of urban agriculture. This is an example similar to the one that we just heard, in the sense of focusing in on a particular project that has been something that came out of the neighborhood. And some of you, I think the chairman and Chairman Anderson had a chance to meet folks around this particular individual project too when you came out to visit the neighborhood. So we're going to go ahead and start with this. This is East Belt Indoor Urban Farm project, and it asked for $3 million to go to this project, and it's to convert an existing facility into an indoor urban farm space with space and support for both local urban farmers and others from the community that would be working with this particular project. The funding would go to planning and startup costs and actually building improvements, a number of different parts of getting us ready to do a very serious urban organic farm in the heart of one of the lowest income communities in the state. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask our City Council member, Alonda Cano, who represents that area, to come up and say a few words first. She does need to get back to City Hall, so I want to have her have a chance before she has to go back.
Okay. And Representative Clark, we have an entire hour for the two bills, okay? So let's plan accordingly.
We'll split it.
Okay. So, well, welcome, Council member.
Good to see you, Representative. How are you?
See you as well. I'm doing fantastic. State your name for the record, please.
Excellent. My name is Alondra Cano, and I'm the City Council member for the 9th Ward, where the East Phillips community is located. And I grew up in Litchfield, Minnesota, which is in Meeker County. And so Representative Dean Erdahl and his kids and I went to school together. So it's really nice to be here today to keep that strong tradition of farming in Minnesota connected both in the rural and the urban community. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the importance of this bill for the people in my ward. The 9th Ward is located in a racially concentrated area of poverty as designated by the Met Council. And so this is an area that really needs the type of investment that Representative Karen Clark is proposing to help us create those sustainable jobs and those 21st century jobs that are going to help us not only address the economic challenges in the community, but also long-term issues around health and community revitalization, as this area has been overburdened with some of the environmental pollution of the city. And so with that, the urban ag community is a strong has a strong presence in the 9th Ward. In fact, we have some community members here who dedicate their time to grow food for the people of Minneapolis and the area. We have Robin from Stone Store Urban Farm, and Jose Luis with the Malas and Bicicletas, and Martin Brown with the Weight House. And all of these community members and workers are really helping us to advance the face of urban agriculture in the Twin Cities and in Minneapolis specifically, and creating ways for our community members to not only have a way to support themselves and their family, but also have a way to support Mother Earth. And so it's very important for our community members to see this investment move forward. And as a city council member, I think what's most important for me as a policymaker for the area is that this would really align with the Green Zones efforts that the city is recently working on. And so not too long ago, Councilmember Cam Gordon, myself, and three other council members passed a resolution to create a Green Zones work group that would help us convene a group of citizens and residents of the area, experts on sustainability, urban agriculture, zoning, and land use, to look at ways to turn around the environmental overpollution in areas that are primarily low-income and diverse, such as the East Phillips community area, which, as you know, is one of the most diverse areas of the entire city, with the largest American Indian population in the nation, the urban American Indian population, a very strong Latino presence, a very strong East African immigrant presence, and we want to see this investment move forward. We think this is going to be a really helpful way for our community members to break the cycle of poverty, to address issues of environmental justice, to look at ways to build our local food economy, and keep those dollars in Minnesota, keep those dollars in Minneapolis. And so I see this as a way to leverage our partnership with the state, to leverage our public and private investments, and to really align some focused energies and have some collective impact around this green zone strategy that we as a city are trying to move forward, which is one of the few and the leading in the nation. And they've been done in California a lot, but we as a city are trying to take that forward as well. So with that, I just hope that you all can consider support for this, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to.
We do have a question, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you used the word leverage, and I might have missed it in the presentation, but is there an amount that the city is providing to support this particular project?
We are looking at exploring ways to support that, and so ideally we would look at the Green Zones pilot program and in ways to align resources and programmatic support. Right now, the work group members have just been selected, and their task is to, over the year, look at policy recommendations that address issues of funding, budgeting, program, and policy to help the Green Zones thrive and grow. And so my expectation is that there will will be some kind of community directive from this work group around the type of investment that the city needs to make to prioritize this initiative and this effort. But at the current moment, the only investment that was presented by the mayor was a $50,000 investment last December that did not make it through the budget cycle. So the expectation is that there would be some kind of budgetary note attached to our process this year, but we don't know quite yet, and we won't know until probably December.
Any other questions? To the council member, I've got a request as well. As far as the request on the dollars for this project, the request on the dollars for the next bill as well, it's substantial dollars. Obviously, we all recognize that. But we are also recognizing, at least I'm recognizing, the importance and the need. One of the things, Representative Clark and I, if I can bring you into this equation too, and you can dispute it if you don't disagree, but we're also looking at the governor's has a proposal for dollars going towards racial disparities. Mm-hmm. And you listen to the testifiers and all the benefits around urban agriculture and agriculture in general and how this can help with racial disparities and equity, if you will. So my request to you is if you could help us, if you and your fellow council members can help us, contact the governor and our leaders in the House and the Senate. Because I think that this urban agriculture initiative would fall into that very, very well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm aware of that conversation, and I appreciate that it's happening, and I thank the governor for his leadership on that front, and I would be happy to do any outreach and relationship building to see how we can move these discussions forward to help the community.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. All right. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say I really appreciate your leadership on that. It's a special insight. So, and one of the things you're going to hear today is some investment that we're going to hear from some private investment that comes along with this bill. That's why we dared to ask for that amount of money. You'll get to hear that in a little while.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, I'd like to call Jose Luis, Senor.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Hello. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jose Luis Villaseñor. I am a resident of East Phillips and a father of three boys. There's currently raising three boys in East Phillips.
Could I please get your last name again?
Villaseñor, Villaseñor.
Thank you so much.
I just want to say thank you for the individuals that I think Chair and Anderson, you guys came and visited East Phillips at the location we're looking at to do some urban farming there. I believe this support is something that will address issues and challenge economic and environmental and food inequities that we currently see in East Phillips. This funding would support initiatives to support sustainable, safe, and healthy communities for all. That at the same time, without the support, pushes issues of diabetes, obesity, in our low-income communities. This will be an opportunity to rehire, train members of the community around urban farming, gain the skill of indoor farming there too as well. Many of you have the packet that we have put out that really also addresses issues of members of our communities to have access to solar and get some of that subsidized, some of the electricity subsidized through this project. At the same time, this is an opportunity for members of the committee that may have not, don't live in the neighborhood or have not come to the neighborhood before to really support a community vision of youth, elders, communities of color, low-income communities have come together to really establish a vision of sustainability and healthy communities. So I want to thank you so much for taking this opportunity to learn more about what we're doing in our communities and bettering our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Villaseñor. Representative Clark?
Yes, thank you. Okay, so next I'd like to call in Carol Pass and Joanna Gill.
Ms. Pass, welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record and begin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioners. And my name is Carol Pass. I am the current chair of East Phillips Improvement Coalition, the neighborhood organization for that area. you've heard a lot of things that I'm not going to repeat, but I want to call attention to the job disparity issue. Is critical for this. It's right in the middle of a community of over 20,000 people, about 80% persons of color, mostly low income, many children, about 7,000 or 8,000 children. And healthy food is a big deal. We don't want it carried here from California. We want it right outside our door. And so it solves distribution issues. But I think one of the things about this is the job situation is you don't have to have a college education for these jobs. It's right near Little Earth, and most of those people are working their way through education, but we have many people who have not completed an advanced degree or even high school. And so we can have these jobs that they can be very proud of. They're cutting-edge jobs. They don't have to feel like they're digging ditches someplace. These are wonderful jobs. And an additional feature of this is that they can walk to work. This is available. You don't have to have a car. And so we have 20,000 people who need jobs where they don't have to have a car, who don't have to have advanced education, jobs they can be proud of. I want to stress those things. They're critical to us. It has less to do with food, but it's a big deal. The food disparity issue, we don't have enough food. We need to train people to want this kind of food all winter, to know that it's important that it isn't shipped here for long range, and so that they are producing their own situation, their own health. Something that hasn't been mentioned enough is that this place that we want to put this, it's right on Highway 55, coming in from the airport. Most business people come down that route, and they are going to the city. And for those of you that represent places in the city, now it looks like an old industrial area with belching fumes. And there's a foundry there and an asphalt plant, and it really looks like we're not a progressive city. We really need to replace that with this wonderful new economic opportunity with the cutting-edge technology. We want this to be a destination where people see en masse something that's transformed an area that was depressed and transformed it into a 21st century light industrial zone. So those are some things that haven't been mentioned, and I think they're crucial to the importance of the site and the importance of this major effort. I brought with me Joanne Hill. She has family living in the Little Earth area, and she can just address some things about the importance of this for this new project.
Ms. Hill, before you turn it over to your testifier,
yeah.
Ms. Hill?
All
right.
Say your name. Hi, I'm Joanna Hill.
All right.
I don't currently live in the Phillips neighborhood right now, but I grew up there, and so I'm really familiar with the neighborhood. And like she said, my mother and my family does still live there. And I just would like to say that I know that it would create really good jobs, and that there's a lot of people in a, you know, Native community and other, you know, community members in that area that would really like to have those kind of jobs, that it would create, you know, opportunities for them. Also being involved with the Mashkiki, I'm sorry I have to mention that, but you know, it's really been a really enriching experience for me because I've been participating in that. So there's a lot of revitalization in the community around like urban agriculture. It's helping Native people to connect with their roots, connect and to feel really, it gives them self-esteem and a lot of pride to also. So it would help them tremendously too with the health disparities that they face in the community today. So part of that agriculture component for the Phillips neighborhood would help to address that.
Thank you, Ms. Hill. Ms. Pass?
Yes.
I want to personally thank you. When you're talking about how agriculture is honorable and it's noble, it's no secret. When I graduated high school, idle hands get in trouble. I never went on to college because I didn't think it was an option. And the way you presented that, like I said, I just want to offer up a personal thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome.
All right. Ms. Bass,
thank you so much for letting us speak. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Hill, thank you for your testimony. Representative Clark.
So then I'd like to call Deb Patel and Dean DeVolis and Fisher. I think I'll let you all come up here at once.
Okay. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Debbie Gotell. I'm the mayor of the city of Richfield. I also am an engineer by trade, and I work in the area of food systems. So this is kind of one of the things that's very near and dear to my heart when I saw that Representative Clark was bringing this forward, and so I volunteered to testify on her behalf, mostly because Richfield has been a great community. It was the urban farm a long time ago that fed the Twin Cities, you know, and now we're fully developed. And but what you're seeing is a resurgence of this as community gardens. But we were fortunate to get a SHIP grant of $1 million, and then Blue Cross Blue Shield stepped up with a lot more dollars. And the cities of Richfield, Edina, and Bloomington actually moved the arrow into the positive direction on health and health initiatives. And that was a real positive thing. We taught kids how to grow food on their grounds of their schools. And now they eat vegetables. How about that, huh? They have salads first in the lunch line, and about a third of those students take salad. This is fabulous. This is what we could do in the Phillips neighborhood, too. We could teach these kids how to do it, and we could teach them again how to cook. We need to teach people how to cook again. And for some of us who grew up on a farm, I did. I know how to put beans away and can them, and I can tomatoes, and I can put up stuff. But a lot of our urban dwellers, they don't know how to do any of those things. Think of what they would do for themselves to have nutritious food all year long. So this is about something that's about the local movement. Everybody wants local food. That's a great thing. But how do you keep it local all year long? You do that with season extension. Season extension means you do something in a more of a sheltered area, or you do it indoors. And the indoor urban garden that we're talking about uses the highest technology of lighting that is LED, so it takes up very little energy. We can make these buildings, if you put thick walls on them, very energy efficient to last the entire year. You can grow all year long. But the knowledge base that you give a community and the jobs that go along with it, with a community kitchen in the whole scope of this, we can teach people how to make products they can sell on their own so they can have their own businesses and become entrepreneurs. There are so many avenues that this will take, and there's ancillary businesses that will come and spring off of this because of that. And it could be a destination, and there could be community activities. So if it's an inviting location. So I think that something like this would also address the idea that we need to look at making our kids healthier, making our population healthier, and addressing the obesity issue. And the obesity issue is about our food. And the better food we have, the better quality, the more we know about what we should and shouldn't eat, that will be helpful for all of us. So I'm very supportive of the efforts here, and I want to thank you for hearing this today. And I'll turn this over to Dean DeVolis.
I just want to say, Mr. Chairman, I asked these three folks to come up because they are part of the private investment that we were talking about bringing to this project. If you look on page 4, we talk about the budget there, and you can go through and look at all the different parts, and you can see that what we're asking for here is $3 million, but the total budget is $9.8 million, and these folks have made some commitments in that direction that I'm really pleased about. So I'll let them continue.
Thank you, Ms. And just for a reminder, you do have another bill up. Split the time, so about 10 more minutes if we could, roughly.
Really short, so it's a good time for Tim. So my name is Dean DeVolis, DJ Architecture. And again, thank you for taking the time to hear us. I'm part of the team. I'm an architect, urban designer, graduated from Harvard, University of Minnesota. And the reason I say that is not like Donald Trump to say I'm really, really smart, but to talk about the seriousness of this bill and what it means and the amount of effort the community has put behind this and the effort that's gone into this whole process to make this a reality. And the one thing I want to say, I've worked in cities, had the privilege of working in Baltimore with Stacy Smith Urban Business Institute and other areas, and the one thing I've discovered is that agriculture and farming is the first industry, I will say, that provides the opportunity for everybody to participate. It does not require the training, all the research, all the everything. I'm going to say that everyone in this room has planted something in their life, has been involved in it, and understands it innately. And as Carol Pass said, has a respect and the opportunity to really build this community and make it happen. And it can become a research, and the idea is that we hope that the Phillips neighborhood becomes a Silicon Valley of food in terms of this bill that's being presented before here, because there's another city that's worked with a great opportunity could come from this, but any idea needs money and thought. So obviously the state's looking at the public purpose, but I also want to talk the private portion of it. I want to introduce Mr. Tim Fisher, who's going to talk about the private commitments as well. So Tim, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee. Thank you so much for allowing me here. I come out of the private sector. I also come out of the record, farm.
Please. I'm sorry. Please state your name for the record.
So I'm sorry.
On tape.
Tim Fisher.
Thank you.
I grew up on a farm. My dad's 82. He's still farming. My mom's 80, and she still fixes breakfast every morning, so we're still connected to that. But I'm here to be the conduit between private business that's constantly looking to invest in honorable programs that were so mentioned. To us, this is an honorable program. This is something that is sustainable. This is something that's necessary. So when I go back to my investors and I lay out a program such as this, this is something that they can get behind. Just as the mayor stated, with the success that you've had with private business. I represent the private business side of it. And then finally, there is a young gentleman from Alexandria, Minnesota, Senator Engelbertson's hometown, who actually started a program called Grow Paradise. And he has something similar to this from the streets of Harlem all the way to the Hawaiian Islands. And I've contacted Anthony, and he is excited about getting involved in this as well, so we can take some of the vast experience that a Minnesota resident has already started. So I'm honored to be here, and again, representing the financial side of some backing that could most probably come through.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted, the handout that you have, Mr. DeVolis is very humble, but this is a lot of his work here that shows the architectural drawings, and he does a lot of pro bono work for our community, and we're very grateful. You can see his work all along Franklin Avenue.
Wonderful.
But if you want to look at this document, you can see some of the vision for the development.
Wonderful. Thank you.
It's a good thing we have friends in high places. Thank you.
Indeed. Representative Park,
so we're wrapping up this. We have wrapped up this particular bill, Mr. Chairman.
All right. So let's open it up for questions now, okay? And if your testifiers can stay kind of close by in case the members have questions for the testifiers. Chair Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark, this is a one-time appropriation, so is the thought or the hope that this would become self-supporting at some point?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we're really talking about sustainability here, and that's why we have both some public investment and private investors that we've been working really hard to bring to the table as a way to keep going. And I think the idea that there will be entrepreneurs here who will continue to grow businesses and so on, we expect it to become self-sustaining. It could take a little while, but that's the goal.
Jerry Anderson?
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. One last question. Looking at the bill, some of the things that you'd be using the money for, I see, is rent. Does that mean you're going to be renting this building, or so after you fix it up, you're still going to be renting? How is that going to work?
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, yes, there would be part, we're hoping that the city, and one of the questions that the chair asked about the city's contributions, we're hoping the city will rent for a reasonable amount for some extended tenure, this particular building that's there. The size of the building and the surrounding acres right there is 7 acres, and the city is still deciding what they're going to do in terms of that building. Are they going to keep it going or not? We would like to rent from them the parts of the current building at a very reasonable rate if possible. We'll see if we can get them to donate part of it. We don't know. The question of rent is something that probably we're going to have to do. If for some reason we end up with another nearby site, then there would probably be some rental of the land as well.
Chair Anderson.
One last question. Thanks, Mr. Chair. So the particular building you're looking at right now, do you say you don't have a long-term commitment yet from the city on that building?
Mr. Chairman, it's in process right now. I think Mr. Villasenor took you over to look at it when you were there in South Minneapolis last year, and it's still in process. You know, it can take a little while to, the city's got a purchase agreement, I believe, with the owner, we're still in process. We just don't want it to become something that's not usable, and we feel like the vision for urban agriculture is something the city can support, and we just need to bring them the rest of the way and make sure that we actually have that site or a similar site very nearby.
Chair Anderson? Any other questions for Representative Clark or the testifiers on this bill? Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Clark, any final words?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I think what was said earlier about this being a vision of a way that people in a very low-income community who have a lot of hunger issues, a lot of issues related to disparities because of being a low-income community of color, Native community, I think this is one of those real hopeful type of investments and proposals, but it's also grounded in reality. We've spent a lot of time putting all these pieces together, and I'm thinking hopefully you see that in the document that's before you. This is not just a passing fancy. This is a very hopefully well thought out and proposal and one that we can go forward with. So appreciate your support, Mr. Chairman. I will say that the governor did solicit a number of proposals to be considered in a supplemental budget. This was one of them. In the end, he didn't do any greenhouses, including like the ones of Duluth that could be another part of what the next bill could help with, so on. But there are a number of structures around the state that could benefit from this type of investment, and this is just one that we feel pretty strongly about.
Oh, thank you, Representative Clark. And the mayor of Richfield, I asked the question to the council member earlier, on these initiatives, if we could get some help and some assistance, leadership, the governor, House, Senate, et cetera, to help everybody understand the importance of this. And like I said, on urban agriculture, I've come a long way. I've learned a great deal. I've grown both of a legislator and a person. And so it's really opened my eyes. So any assistance that you can give us as well, it would be greatly appreciated. And my son lives in your community. Yeah. So, side.
Well, Mr. Cherry lives in the best community here in the Twin Cities. I'm so glad to hear that. And so thoughtful. But I do want to say yes, and the governor, I would be happy to present this to the governor. We have had conversations with the Department of Health about some of the initiatives we have done on the growing and what's happening, and especially because we have a very diverse community in the city of Richfield, also with pockets of poverty, same as the Phillips neighborhood. So we are dealing with the same things, and that's why I think we're kindred souls here, and I'd be happy to carry that message and carry that water up to the governor's office.
Thank you, Madam Mayor, and thank you for your service as well. Representative Clark then renews her motion that House File 2818 will be held over for possible inclusion. Representative Clark?
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Now the bill that you've been waiting for that we have put together as a result of the earlier presentation of the governor's task force that went around and talked about with individuals all over the state about what is urban agriculture, what could it look like. And some of you on the policy committee have already heard some of the testimony. We've asked a few other additional people to come today. But we're going to go ahead and start with Paku Heng, who is one of the individuals. I want to call your attention to the bill very briefly as she's coming up. So what this bill does, it's a pilot project that establishes urban agriculture. It defines it, as was the mandate for that group that went around and talked to all the stakeholders. Those of you who were on this committee last year, we had this bill last year, but it's modified considerably. It now includes cities from 10,000 up, plus individuals, nonprofit organizations, cooperatives, and you don't have to have 10,000 people if you're if at least 10% of the population is comprised of communities of color or Native American tribal communities. That are living at 200% of poverty or below. And that really expands this bill from what we originally brought to you last year. And I think it's input of a number of legislators here, but also people in the community who said this is a statewide issue. There are urban communities all over the state that need to have this kind of attention, and there's sometimes smaller urban communities. You can see that it has competitive grants that would be prescribed by the commissioner, and those 18 different criteria there are a result, or 19 actually, are a result of the hearings that went on around the state. So you could look at that and see, kind of what the values are that were being proposed. One of them was discussed with the Duluth proposal. When you're talking about urban agriculture, one of the difficult problems is land tenure, knowing the security of having the land that you've put a lot of time and energy into, put new soil, developed it. And so one of the things this bill does is it provides an incentive for those areas to for the folks that are getting the grants. They need to have a 5-year, 10-year, and if not, the grant needs to be repaid, and there's a penalty that goes along with that. So we're really trying to make sure that we can have more security for these urban farmers. The only exception to that land tenure issue is if affordable housing would be proposed instead on that site. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Paco Heng, who's got some special expertise to share with us.
All right, just a minute. I'm not sure if we move the bill.
So yes, and Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House 3324, and I need to clarify one other thing. There is an amendment that I did present. We had it in the policy committee, but I forgot. I can't believe it. I forgot to get it to your folks for this committee, so I apologize for that. It's H3324A2. And basically what that does is it extends the limits to include what's called peri-urban area that came out of the governor's recommendation task force. It means basically some of the suburban areas and areas in smaller towns around the state. And it clarifies that when cities have this, if they become the recipients, that they have a period of 5 years after receiving the grant. And this was important, as particularly to the League of Minnesota Cities and the Metro Cities folks who wanted to make sure that we were clarifying that this is a 5-year limit. And I think I thank them for those words. And with that, they do support the bill, both of those organizations. I should also mention the Minnesota Farmers Union is supporting the bill. Maybe more than we even know. There might be others. So we'll keep going, Mr. Chair.
All right. So just some formalities here. Then House File 3324, Representative Clark moves House File 3324 to be held over for possible inclusion. We do have the A2 amendment. Members, this did not meet the 24-hour rule. I did speak to the vice chair. I spoke to the lead for the minority lead as well. And everybody's... they seem to be okay if we go ahead and waive that rule. Is there any opposition from members to waive the rule to take up this amendment to get it in the shape of the author? And like the author said, the League and others support this amendment as well. Hearing none, we're going to go ahead and move then the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much for that.
You're welcome, Representative Clark. Paco. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paco Heng, and I'm the Executive Director of the Hmong American Farmers Association. And, Mr. Chair, if you would mind just indulging me for a second, I'd just like to make a quick comment about something you said earlier before I delve into my prepared statement. You had said before that this is a committee that doesn't and shouldn't tear down a part of agriculture, one aspect or one group of agriculture to raise another, and I just wanted to thank you so much for those words. In addition to working with the Hmong American Farmers Association, I participated in the past 2 years in an organization called the Minnesota Agriculture and Rural Leadership Program, MARLS. Some of you may be familiar with that program, but it's been a life-changing experience for me. And one of the things I took out of that program is that it didn't matter if you were a farmer from Welcome, Minnesota, or from Minneapolis, that we were just folks who were trying to do, you know, a good job, work hard, have a noble profession, and take care of our family. And so I just want to thank you for the values that you've enclosed this committee in. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, like I said, my name is Paco Heng, and I thought for the purposes of this short statement, I would tell you a little bit about the programs that my organization runs, and then I talk about the impact of what we've done, really as an example of what the benefits could be for this pilot project. So the Hmong American Farmers Association works with over 128 farmers, Hmong farmers in the metro area. We, based on our projections, there's probably over 500 Hmong farming families. These are families that rely mainly on agriculture for their livelihoods. And this is almost equivalent to the number of mainstream farmers in Dakota County. So this is not an insignificant group of farmers. My organization works with these farmers to help them access land. We actually manage a farm right in Vermilion Township. If you travel down to Rochester, you'll see a weird land kind of at 200th Street and Highway 52 South where there's a deer fence and there's little sheds that spike up. Well, that's our farm. We have a 155-acre farm there. We help our farmers, in addition to accessing land, we help our farmers access alternative markets besides the farmers market. We help our farmers farmers get access to microloans, to business management training. We help our farmers to access research opportunities, and then, of course, training opportunities to build their own capacity. And I want to highlight one specific program that I think has been really beneficial, not just for my farmers, but for other folks in the community. We, this last year and this year, we're teaming up with some food shelves in what we call our market return program. So many of my farmers harvest a lot of produce on Friday nights, and they take them to the farmers markets on Saturday and Sunday, and they try to sell all the produce. But, you know, farmers markets are kind of fickle, so they don't always sell everything. And come Sunday, they might have all this produce, and they're just going to throw it away, right, because it's no longer fresh. And so we teamed up with some of the food shelves in local areas in our market return program, where on Monday morning, we will contact some of these food shelf coordinators. We will say, we have X number of potatoes, X number of carrots. And prior to the season, we've all agreed on a set price that they would buy these market returns, so maybe 50 cents, 75 cents per pound, no matter what it is, even if it's a high-end ground cherry or just, you know, your regular Yukon potato. These food shelves will get fresh produce, and it's a win-win for them as well as a win for our farmers because they're just not dumping the produce. So these are ways that my farmers are trying to find economic opportunity but also give back to the community. Because of the services that the Hmong American Farmers Association is providing for our farmers, just last year in our second growing season on the farm, we produced over 22 new jobs, of which the average wage was $13 an hour. Our farmers saw a 20% increase in their sales in just that 1 year because of having land tenure, having the infrastructure, having the facilities on the farms that before they didn't have. We also saw a 90% increase in farmers using cover crops, as well as a doubling of farmers who signed up for crop insurance. And as a result of the work on the farm, our farmers, we project that our farmers' produce are actually feeding over 200,000 people in the metropolitan area, and of that, 70,000 of them are young children through the Head Start program or through many of the schools that we sell our produce to. And one of the most proud of is that also because of the work that HAFA has been providing, we are going to be launching at the end of this year 10 new value-added products through our farmers. And actually, we're specifically working with the children of our farmers, so second-generation farmers, to continue work in agriculture of food. So they may not be farming the same way that their parents are, but they're going to be continuing to continue with the family business in some ways. And that's really important for us because as an economic development organization, we're interested in uplifting the economic prosperity of our farmers as well as their children and grandchildren. And we do all of this on a budget of about $1.7 million. My staff is about 8 full-time staffers, and this budget, while it may seem, you know, large for a nonprofit, over 500,000 of this actually was to invest in infrastructure, actual facilities like coolers and deer fence, things that we had to do because of federal food safety laws that are coming down. And so even if we wanted to sell, let's say, to the hospitals or some of the retailers, we can't if we didn't have coolers on hand, if we didn't have, you know, deer fences to protect us from contamination. So this really goes to the point of this pilot project, and, you know, $20 million seems like a lot. But I'll tell you, as a practitioner and as executive director who's always trying to find these funds, you know, $1.7 million is nearly, it's always never enough for the work and the need that's out there.
I'm sorry, just a reminder. We do have other testifiers. Yep. Representative Clark, I'm going to need your help to make sure that we get everybody. We have a hard break at noon. So please continue, Ms. Hang.
So that concludes my comments. Thank you.
Wow. You are fantastic, Paku. Paku is a dear friend. I think the world of her. So thank you so much.
Mr. Chair. Okay, so good. Next I call Nadia Abinacci, and I think she might be coming with somebody.
And if I can just remind all the testifiers, Representative Clark, you're going to have to help me manage the time of the testifiers, okay?
I think I've told everybody about 2 minutes.
All right. Thank you. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nadia Burnish. I wear a couple of different hats here. I am the co-chair of the St. Paul Ramsey County Food Nutrition Commission. I'm the program director at a small nonprofit organization called Gardening Matters, and I also serve on the leadership team for the Metro Food Access Network. Some of you who were part of the policy hearing are familiar with the Minnesota Food Charter because I brought these as special gifts for that committee, and I'm going to hand these out again to the Finance Committee because I want to address a couple of things in the Food Charter. If you would, the reason I want to start with the Food Charter just very briefly is because I want to, because I want to just take a second to talk about the food system and the importance of urban agriculture as a piece in improving our food system in Minnesota to create health and access to safe, healthy, and affordable food for all Minnesotans. And the Minnesota Food Charter was introduced about a year and a half ago, and it presents a number of strategies to improve our food system here. It was produced by a robust community engagement process where thousands of Minnesotans gave feedback. And you'll see that what it is a shared roadmap for how we can improve our food systems to create healthy food access where Minnesotans work, live, play, and learn. So I refer to this document because, again, urban agriculture is an important piece of that puzzle, and I'd like to just especially turn attention to page 7, which talks a little bit about some of the economic costs for urban agriculture and for food systems as a whole. We know that we have hunger as a problem in Minnesota. We know that there is an economic impact for some of the health disparities we face. We have $2.8 billion in obesity-related health care costs per year and $17 billion of lost productivity. But we also have some opportunity that they have figured here in terms of solutions that promote health and prosperity. We have the potential for $11 billion in savings by increasing access to healthy food and economic opportunity. So we have some return on investment here and some important return on investment in terms of investing in healthy food infrastructure and agriculture that could result in $2.9 billion in savings. So as this is the Finance Committee, I wanted to just point out some concrete dollar amounts there.
Thank you.
I also want to talk about the importance of the bill and disparities, and you've heard about this from a number of testifiers, but I think that this is just an important thing that we all want to emphasize, that this this bill specifically directs funds to the communities that need it most, and particularly 50% of the funding going to communities of color and tribal communities around the state. I also want to just take a minute to talk about how we arrived at a $20 million number. We knew that we would get questions about that dollar number and where it came from, and there was a lot of community feedback around this bill. This bill has been in the works for several years, as you know, and what we've seen over these years is increasing interest in urban ag enterprises. If you look at the Urban Ag Report, you see a number of organizations that are involved in urban agriculture that have an interest in this bill and these funds, and there's pent-up demand and need from around the state. So what we were hearing is that there is a lot of interest in this kind of work, and it spans a lot of different kinds of activities. So our ask is just a demonstration of the pent-up demand and need from a number of different organizations, and a lot of these needs are infrastructure needs. And so we're talking about season extension, technical assistance, aggregation methods, soil remediation, land access, and a lot of these things could be one-time infrastructure investments. So that's just some of the background on where that number came from. We said we want to demonstrate that there is significant need, and there's also significant return on investment possible from these funds. The other thing I want to talk about is the innovation that's possible with some of these urban agriculture methods. I think you've heard some examples here today, but we want to emphasize that urban agriculture is an area that's primed for innovation. And there are some unique challenges presented by having land access challenges, by having soil remediation challenges, by having winter season and wanting to extend that. But urban agriculture has the opportunity to think about creatively solutions to these challenges and be able to complement our entire food system. So I also really thank you, Chairman Hamilton, for your comments about how we complement each other here and we lift each other all up rather than work against each other. I think that the way we're talking about urban agriculture in this bill and in the food charter is to talk about how we can complement each other and share strategies and innovations. I think I wanted to share one quick example about how urban agriculture combines health and food access and innovation. And that's really quickly, you may be familiar with the Twin Cities Mobile Market. It is a bus that travels around the Twin Cities, and right now it goes to many public housing sites where residents have challenges accessing food because they have transportation challenges or health challenges or many other things. They purchase as much as they can from local farmers grown around the Twin Cities, and then they are able to get it to the people who need it most. So you have with this a story of a woman who had been eating from a vending machine because she simply couldn't get to a grocery store. She had been eating all of her meals from a vending machine. When the mobile market showed up, she was able to buy fruits and vegetables that were grown locally and bought from a farmer. So we're supporting the businesses and local development. And as a result, she lost 25 pounds. She's taking less insulin. Her health has improved greatly. The mobile market is an innovative strategy that has helped to do this, and the farmers that are actually growing these things in urban agriculture have viable business as a result. So it's a great example of the innovation that can happen with health and with food access. I just briefly also want to just address one of the dilemmas that Mr. Hugonen talked about in his report, and that is that some of urban agriculture may belong in the Department of Ag and some may belong in other departments. And philosophically that may seem true, but right now we're at a place where economic development or the Department of Health or Department of Commerce don't really get urban agriculture. I think we're just starting to get urban agriculture in a lot of places, and it's great that urban agriculture has so many benefits that people are saying it belongs here, it belongs here, it belongs here. But I think that one of the challenges then is that when we have multiple agencies, we may not have a knowledge base that we need to be able to support that. So right now we're in ag because ag has the knowledge base that we need to support it. And with urban agriculture, even if it's commercial urban agriculture, it has all these other benefits with it. It has the health benefits, it has the youth development benefits, it has the economic benefits. So we don't want to split up the benefits. We want to be able to say, we have all these benefits, we have the knowledge base here, let's start here and go from there.
Thank you. Thank Representative you. Clark,
Mr. Chairman.
We have about 12 minutes. I think we may have some questions for you or to the bill, so we want to leave 5 minutes to that.
I will leave that. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask some people to come down and get ready to testify. Thank you very much.
Representative Clark, if I could, please, because, you know, I won't hold the gavel, right?
Yes, you
just
do.
Reason. We have some students up there.
We do.
Could
and
I
then,
please
in
bring
fact,
them down? I want to hear from them.
Let's bring them down. I'd like to ask Mr. Martinez to come down, too. He's also a student, and he took off from school today to be here. And
yes.
So let's have all of our students that are here. The students from Muskegon in South Minneapolis, students from Urban Roots in St. Paul.
Thank you, Representative Clark. And I was just teasing by the get. No, I wasn't. So I had a wonderful opportunity to meet with some of the students earlier, so I'd really like, and I think the committee would as well. State your name for the record and begin. And we do have a hard break at noon. We're going to have to move on. So if you can keep your testimony short, that would be wonderful.
All right. My name is Abel Martinez. I'm 16, or 17. I just had a birthday. But I guess I represent the Muskegon Gitsagon. It's an urban farm in East Phillips neighborhood. I feel like this bill would really, like, our farm would do, like, benefit from this bill a lot just because, like, as, like, they said before, people speaking up here, that the East Phillips neighborhood is, like, a community of color. And, personally, the reason I like farming with this farm is because, like, it has, like, a native kind of cultural spin on it. So we grow, like, indigenous plants that have been in this area from, like, the Dakota and Ojibwe people. So that's why one of the reasons why I like gardening, and it's just kind of, for me, it's just kind of like decolonization through, like, gardening and stuff, because it's, like, what we always talk about in our communities. And I feel like the other Native American, like, residents here will benefit from this a lot, too, just because, like, the only access they have to food up there kind of really is, like, corner stores and commodities. And a lot of the communities up there have been starting urban farms, especially like up in like Red Lake and like Hess Lake. They've been starting urban farms, and everyone kind of in the Native community has really like appreciated the farms just because they get like a different access to food, different healthier food, and like a lot of the Native people have are prone to like health diseases like diabetes. The Native American people are the most like people affected by this, and I've like heard like of a guy who had gotten diabetes. You know, he was like overweight, and he started eating like fruits and vegetables that he grown in his on his property, and his health just kind of like completely like flipped, and he was like super healthy. He didn't have to take as much insulin as he needed, and he just like completely benefited from this. So I feel like this bill will like benefit my people a lot, and yeah.
Mr. Martinez, you've been here before.
Yeah.
You're fantastic. And someday, we expect you to be sitting up here. All right? So keep that in mind.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Who's the next testifier? State your name for the record.
My name is Imogene Silver. I am with Urban Roots. I am
Ms. Silver? Is that right?
Yes.
Silver. All right.
I am 17, and I am a junior at Johnson High School on the east side of St. Paul. And so I just wanted to talk a little bit about my impact and perspective of working in an urban gardening program.
So I have been working at Urban Roots for coming on 4 years, and this has been a really important part of this part of my life. To me, this job has been more than just a paycheck. It's allowed me to connect to the community in so many different ways. I get a lot of one-on-one with members of the community. I can see the visual difference that our garden makes. One of the gardens is just blocks from my house, and I love to see how it grows throughout the season. And also, working at this job has allowed me to see how the food we're growing has an impact on the community and the health of the community. One of the things I get to do is go out to schools and teach cooking classes on healthy recipes to kids in the community. And these are all things that I would not have been able to get without this urban gardening program. And not only is this helping connect me to the community, it's also helping me gain skills. This was my first job. I got this job when I was 14. And this one of the things I do is make sure that we really know all our basic job skills. And I've also been able to build a lot of entrepreneurial job skills through working at the farmers market. So increasing the funds available for programs like Urban Roots would increase the amount of opportunities for other youth to have jobs like I have right now. Being involved in Urban Roots and being involved in this urban farming and gardening program has made me more confident about my future going into the workforce and the skills that I have to offer that will give me a competitive advantage.
Thank you, Ms. Silver. Fantastic. Who's next?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tony Lee. I am 16 and a junior at Central High School. I've been working at Urban Roots for 4 years in the market garden program that grows and sells produce. And as a Hmong American, I have been involved in agriculture because my grandma does agriculture for her living. And I think this bill will be nice because more youth will be more involved in agriculture and be more educated in healthy eating and be educated in the environment. And I think that this will be benefit the youth.
Great job, Mr. Lee. Next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Hase Tai Lee, and I am a youth at Urban Roots. I've been here for 3 years. What the most important thing I think is how it offers the low-income family youths to rely on themselves and not have to wait for their family or like their parents to buy their clothes and ask them like, can you buy it to me? And then they have to wait. Instead, we can just go out on our own and just buy it. And the skills that it offers is like very good leadership skills. We don't know if we're gonna be farmers, but we know that that we gain the skills like entrepreneurship skills, and it's really helpful.
Could you please state your last name again for the record?
Haile, H-A-I-L-E.
H-A-I-L-E. I-L-E.
Thank you.
Haile. Thank you so much.
But I just want to know, these are not only future farmers, they're current farmers.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're fantastic. One more testifier?
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you what, as you're getting a great testimony, you guys did an excellent job. I'll hopefully come back and see us again sometime, okay?
Thank you.
Fantastic. And we got the future governor, the future mayor, the future city council member, the future president. Don't ever forget that. Representative Clark.
We're going to wind up with Michael Cheney from Project Sweetie Pie, who's going to, I think, say just a couple more words. You all have had a chance to meet him mostly before, but maybe a little wrap-up, and then any questions that you have, I'd be glad to try to.
Thank you so much. Mr. Cheney, welcome again, my friend. It's welcome, great to see you.
I just want to comment on the remarks that were made earlier that government moves kind of slow. We've been working on this for, you know, the last 4 years when we first went and met with Representative Boppy, and so I'm glad to applaud each of you for allowing us to move this forward. But this is a remarkable time. The folks that were here talking about tree planting and the pilot project on that, we actually on Earth Day will be planting 50 trees on a tree farm, the pilot project with the gravel project at North High. So, you know, it's good. I like to say that you've got the Ohio and the Missouri, but by the time you get to Louisiana, it's called the Mississippi. So that's what I feel has happened here today, that there's a lot of minds that have come together. I like to say it takes a village to raise a child. It also takes a village to raise a sweet potato. So thank you.
Mr. Cheney, we have some
I like his coat, Mr. Chair.
Pardon me?
I like his coat.
Yeah, they're manufactured up in your district, up in your area.
Right.
Hey, Mr. Cheney, we have some youth in the area here. You have a poem that you recite. Could you do that again for us, please?
Aren't you bored by that by now?
I am not.
North Minneapolis is going green. Give us a call and learn what we mean. Where once lie urban blight, now sits luscious garden sites. Gardens without borders, classrooms without walls. Architects of our own destinies, access to food, justice for all. When the governor came to North Minneapolis to talk about economic disparities, I quickly rushed over to his office with Lawford Baxter, Jamaican-born farm boy. Last year did $30 million in sales in cut fruit. They're now, we're proud to say that he's going to be moving to North Minneapolis. He's doing a partnership with a group out of Faribault called Living Greens. And so by August of this coming year, they're going to be packaging and growing organic greens in North Minneapolis. We got a $50,000 grant from the University of Minnesota to do proof of concept. And so we're going to be training that workforce that's going to be working with Living Green. So things have come full circle, and we applaud you for your willingness to hear us here today.
Thank you, Mr. Cheney. I appreciate that. Representative Clark, I have some questions on some language within the bill.
Okay.
I don't want to run short. We just have a few minutes here. And I'm looking for a little bit of guidance. I wonder, this bill is going to be held over for possible inclusion. And I wonder either, and I want some feedback here. I don't know if members have additional comments or questions for Representative Clark specifically to the bill, but I don't want to cut us off either. And if there isn't, Representative Clark, I wonder if we couldn't, you and I, talk about them then, if it's being held over for possible inclusion, in essence of time. And then I also met a remarkable young man when we left here, so I'm going to jump to that. If we can work on, you know, the language and whatnot, you know, after it's held over.
Mm-hmm.
I met a remarkable young man right outside the chamber after Representative, or outside of the room after Representative Anderson's committee, Chair Anderson's committee, and he wanted to testify, Representative Clark. And so I don't know if he's willing to testify today, but if he is, I'd like to take the last 3 minutes to hear from this young man. Would that be okay, Representative Clark?
Sure, and I would say, Mr. Chairman, there's a number of other people here who we just couldn't get on the agenda because of time limitations. So I don't know who you're referring to, but there's definitely, you know, there are a number of folks that I would be happy to have testify if you...
Well, I'm looking at his mother. Is he interested? Does he want to testify today? Said yes, bring him down.
Welcome. Oh, that's terrific. And we can welcome his mom, Tish.
So, and to the other testifiers, again, I know how important this is. I know how passionate you are on this as well. I think the other testifiers probably captured, hopefully they captured what your thoughts are. But this young man, he was absolutely remarkable. He had a message for all of us. And we're going to give you, sir, the final words for testifier today. So if you'd state your name for the record and begin, please. Come on, buddy.
Come. He's going to do the big. Tell him your name.
Ethan.
Speak loud.
Ethan.
Welcome, Ethan.
Ethan what?
Ethan Mason Penny.
He said Ethan Mason Penny.
Very nice to meet you. So you shared a message to me the other day. Share it with the rest of the group, please.
That I want to go to school.
You want to go to school?
Mm-hmm. Why were you here last week? What did you tell him?
I told him I wanted to ring the bell.
What? I know. Why are you here?
Because I had to ring the bell.
No. Why are you testing? Sorry, he's only three, you guys. He totally forgot.
He's doing great.
So, give us... Why are you here to testify?
Because I need to ring the bell.
All right. He wanted to ring the bell.
He wanted to ring the bell, but tell why are you here. What is your passion to what?
I don't know.
Oh.
It's okay.
So how about mother? Can your mom please say what your message was? Would you please?
Uh-huh.
Well, what his message was that...
State your name for the record.
What?
I'm Fish Penny, and what? I'm his mother, and I'm starting him earliest because I want him to be the next generation for his generation to learn the skills, because he already knows the skills at three. Because I've been knowing the skills since for 8 years, and being with Sweetie Pie for 3 years and being with Mrs. Clark, being an intern for her taught me a lot, especially because I need a mentor. I didn't have a mother, and I didn't have a father, and I didn't have family, so I needed family to get me out of trouble, to get me out of trauma. So being with amazing people and my elders helped me to get me out of my trauma and my history, and also for us to learn my roots as well, because I too had farmers in my background and cotton picking, and just amazing stories of people in my family were gardeners, were agriculture people, you know. And by being with Karen and Mr. Cheney and other elders, as I say, I learned a lot, and it woke me up to understand myself and what I need to do. And so by eating healthy, I want to live longer so I could be the next testimony of my son and to provide for the community, not just in the community I didn't know about, because I came from a middle-class family, and then I ended up poor in Minnesota. But being around these type of people had made me who I am today, to be strong, to keep standing tall, and to eat healthy, to believe in myself, to be able to grow food because I couldn't afford it, because I had to, because of being homeless with my children. And one thing of how I survived everything, by being around Mrs. Clark and Mr. Cheney, of to survive eating healthy, to be able to give my car, to grow food. I didn't know how to understand how to eat healthy, and so my children keep me alive, and that's why I bring him along. And because he know how to farm. He know what's the difference between an apple. By being at Mrs. Clark Farm, I take my children there. And that's why I bring him here, so he could learn how to be the president, because he said he wanted to be the president last week. And because he said he wants to be a lawyer for me, because he wants to help me. So that's why I brought my child. And the only reason I don't have child. But I wanted him to learn from people like you guys, so he could, like I said, so he could be the next generation to teach, you know, his youth. And then he could teach us, because he's teaching us. He's teaching Mr. Cheney. He's teaching the North High School. I bring him to North High School for him to teach the kids how to eat healthy. And they was amazed by this three-year-old boy was not eating unhealthy chips, but he was eating guacamole chips. And he knew what an apple was. He knew what a veggie was. Michael was trying to get him to eat it, but he's like, "You can't tell me. I eat too much of these."
Thank you.
So you know, I was like, "Wow." You know, he was putting spark in those eyes. So
thank you.
He's shy, but he just wanted to say he's here to get money from you guys, so he can help his community to eat healthy and to get more farmers out, urban farming, and to help the community.
Well, thank you so much for your testimony. And it was, Representative Clark, it was wonderful. And I went out there. He wasn't shy at all.
No.
I heard all about it. So I just wanted to give him the chance because he wanted to testify. And so Representative Clark, thank you for that. Representative Clark renews the motion.
Thank you.
Hold over. File 3324 as amended. Here's Representative Clark.
Many members.
All right, with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.